From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lori Walsh, your host of In the Moment. Human beings have an incredible capacity for creative problem solving, amazing accomplishment, and fantastic feats. This week, In the Moment reflects on what humans can do when we set our sights on something. We'll focus on four stories from the week. First, we'll look at the audacity of humankind while reflecting on the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 launch. Then, overcoming the wounds of war and repurposing struggle and trauma in service to the other. Plus, striving to build a society where every voice is somehow heard. But first, a look at a South Dakota research team's effort to overcome one of engineering's greatest hurdles. Humans love to build. We build to survive. We build to create. Every stage of the construction process has a measurable environmental and human impact. Mining used to source materials, transportation of the materials to the building site, the construction process itself, and the waste removal and disposal process. As humans race to build, it's worth asking, would change be too fantastic a feat? Dr. Brett Lingwall is a researcher studying fungus-growing termites. Termites also love to build. He says when it comes to engineering, nature is often our best teacher. So here's the question. How can humankind mimic natural engineering to solve some of mankind's biggest problems? What can scientists learn about engineering from watching these termites? What's the point of all this?
Well, there's a lot that we can learn. The first thing I'm going to start with is kind of a 30,000-foot view. Human infrastructure and our society, we kind of float on a sea of diesel fuel. Like everything we do, all our materials, our construction materials, the construction itself, the maintenance, everything requires diesel fuel and or gasoline. Whether we're talking about producing steel, producing Portland cement concrete, lumber, all of these things we're building with require diesel fuel for the production, the transportation, the installation, the maintenance. Things come to a site. They come to a site on a truck. The truck burns diesel. The diesel supply globally is not going to last forever. It's just not. We can look at like electric transport and things like that, autonomous connected vehicles that are battery operated. But in the end, we use diesel fuel because it is extremely efficient. We get a lot of bang for our buck. We can't get that bang for our buck from other fuel sources necessarily. So while some people are working on alternative fuels, what we're working on is we're trying to develop new building materials that can be locally sourced with a minimum of diesel fuel. In the end, that's what it kind of boils down to. Because nature, when nature's building anything, there's not a drop of diesel being used.
Right. And things aren't coming from great distances either.
Exactly. It's all locally sourced. People talk farm to table in terms of their food, but for construction materials, what can we use that is locally sourced that is durable? It meets the needs of the performance needs of human structure. The reason we call this bio-inspired engineering rather than just biomimicry is we're not just simply seeking to recreate the material that the termites are building, but we have to learn fundamental principles from what they're doing, understand how their material behaves, and then we have to transition it to a material that can meet human performance objectives for human structures. So there's the bio part, which is studying what the termites are doing, how they're doing it, the end product, and then the engineering part is figuring out how to make that in an anthropological, you know, a human-derived product that can have those benefits that we see in nature, but meeting human performance objectives.
So let me ask you this. You've got a scientist, say, who's just fascinated with, you know, you've got your termite entomologist and just fascinated with what the termites are doing and asking all those great questions. And then you've got a scientist who's an engineer and is thinking about how to solve problems of building here in the Black Hills. Those two scientists have to be working together, and that's a simplification. But let's talk a little bit about just scientists collaborating to try to get all this knowledge woven together in a way that impacts human life today.
No, that's a great question. So a little bit of background in response to that is, for a long time, science and engineering has been what we've called siloed. The civil engineers, we work with the other civil engineers. Maybe we'll reach across and work with a mechanical engineer or an electrical engineer. We would call that interdisciplinary research. So things have been very siloed, very close to one's field of study for a long time. However, the problems facing society are increasingly complex. Some people call them wicked problems. So a wicked problem or a complex problem is something that has that cannot be solved by me, a professor in civil engineering, walking down the hall to a mechanical engineer and just saying, hey, let's work this thing out between the two of us. It's going to be far more difficult than what we can do with our set of expertise. So on this project, we have the structural engineer. We have an expert in cementitious materials, a Portland cement expert who's working on the cement side. My background is in soil and rock engineering, and we have a microbiologist who's working on the microbial biocement part of this. We have a person whose background is in ceramics and material science. We have the biologists. We have collaborators who are not part of the funded research team, but collaborators working on termite behavior rather than the biology. We have collaborators who are working on the ecosystem that they're surviving in. Because there's so many different things, no one single set of expertise can ever hope to solve these really complex problems. And this really is the future of science and engineering, is reaching across the aisle, so to speak, and scientists talking to engineers, and then talking to people from outside traditional STEM education or STEM fields, talking to people like economists, people who deal with human behavior and what people are interested in, and really rounding out our set of expertise to something that can solve these really complicated problems.
And that also includes all of us, doesn't it? Listeners who just sort of, you know, aren't necessarily going to do the research, but are going to support the research in some ways and sort of celebrate science as a whole. That's important too, isn't it?
Absolutely. The point about science and engineering, if it does not have an end use, an end user, a benefit to society, some sort of a broader impact, well, it was neat and it was interesting, but it really didn't serve its purpose. Mm-hmm. Without the people who are going to be using these materials, and you know, if we develop a better way to build a brick or a panel wall for a structure, it's going to be a part of people's homes or their business. They have a stake in this, and their opinion, it really does matter. We're not trying to do anything in isolation just for our own personal interest, right, but ourselves. We have a view to what's the impact of society. The funding agencies are thinking, what's the impact to society? And so we have to have society's impact in whatever we're doing in science and engineering.
We meet in an hour of change and challenge, in a decade of hope and fear, in an age of both knowledge and ignorance. The greater our knowledge increases, the greater our ignorance unfolds. No man can fully grasp how far and how fast we have come. But condense, if you will, the 50,000 years of man's recorded history in a time span of but a half a century. Stated in these terms, we know very little about the first 40 years, except at the end of them, advanced man had learned to use the skins of animals to cover them. Then about 10 years ago, under this standard, man emerged from his caves to construct other kinds of shelter. Only 5 years ago, man learned to write and use a cart with wheels. Christianity began less than 2 years ago. The printing press came this year. And then less than 2 months ago, during this whole 50-year span of human history, the steam engine provided a new source of power. Newton explored the meaning of gravity. Last month, electric lights and telephones and automobiles and airplanes became available. Only last week did we develop penicillin and television and nuclear power. This is a breathtaking pace. And such a pace cannot help but create new ills as it dispels old. So it is not surprising that some would have us stay where we are a little longer, to rest, to wait. If this capsule history of our progress teaches us anything, it is that man in his quest for knowledge and progress is determined and cannot be deterred. We shall send to the moon, 240,000 miles away, a giant rocket more than 300 feet tall on an untried mission to an unknown celestial body and then return it safely to Earth. But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone. And therefore, as we set sail, we ask God's blessing on the most hazardous and dangerous and greatest adventure on which man has ever embarked.
It was a feat so fantastic, some believed it just had to be faked. This week, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the launch of Apollo 11 and man's first step on the lunar surface. We reached out to author, scholar, and poet Patrick Hicks for thoughts on what might be the last time we all stood in wonder at one monumental effort.
The moon is 240,000 miles away from Earth. And if you look at the popular way that we think of the moon, we think of it as a fairly close object. But if the Earth was the size of a basketball and the moon was the size of a baseball, and that's pretty accurate to the sizes that those objects would be, you would have to have them 23 feet apart from each other. 23 feet. I mean, to send human beings that gigantic distance is audacious and crazy. Yeah. And of course, you have to aim at where the moon's going to be in 3 days.
That always brings me back to one of my favorite questions that nobody knows how to answer, but like, who did we think we were? You know, like when I meet people who do these really brave and bold things, I think, what were you thinking? I mean, what was that? And a lot of times people just say, I just moved forward. I just did what needed to be done.
Yeah. And talking to the astronauts, certainly in subsequent interviews with Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, they said that while they were concerned about the other things that had to happen correctly for them to actually get to the moon, as far as they were concerned, landing on the moon was the most difficult portion of it. The actual walking wasn't that complicated. Really, I mean, it was something joyous and an amazing sort of thing to experience. But from a technological perspective, it wasn't as dangerous as the actual landing.
When someone when you posted that you were going to be on the show today on Facebook, somebody posted they should have sent a poet.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I find so fascinating about this time and listening to that to the archival footage is how many people really wax poetic, from the astronauts themselves to the people who were talking about it. They got, as human beings, we were all poets at that moment, weren't we?
I think the planet was, and I'd even go so far as say it was the last time that the entire planet was swept up in one singular event, where for a glorious sort of 3 days we were all looking at the moon as a species. And it wasn't America that landed on the moon. Technically, yes, it was us, but it was bigger than that. It was we as a species, because of course the technology that got Apollo 11 to the moon had been millennia in the creating, from math and rocketry and physics and all of these kind of things. There's that sense of wonderment. But I know that that quote, they should have sent a poet, I think I'm going to attribute that to Michael Collins, who was the command module pilot of Apollo 11. He was the guy that orbited while Neil and Buzz landed on the moon. I'm pretty sure he was the one that said they should have sent a poet because he's a great writer. He wrote Carrying the Fire, which was about his account of being on the Apollo 11 crew, and he's a really good writer. But he was aware that they needed someone that could frame things through words, because people would ask them, what was it like to walk on the moon? And all of them would say, we were test pilots. They're pretty quiet. I mean, they were there to make sure things were going well in rendezvous orbits. And, the idea of emoting and waxing about what that moment meant was not something that they had a natural calling for, but yet the world demanded it of them when they came home.
Mm. these people who were part of this program, and there were so many Americans that were involved in the program that it just, you know, it reached so far. But the core people, the astronauts themselves, the scientists, you know, the administrators who were trying to make this happen, that has to be, like, what do you know about that camaraderie and that sort of family that they, I mean, they must have been telling that story forever. Like, you know, you have those stories that, you know, you experience with someone when you were a certain age, and there's nobody who really understands it except that
the person that was there.
Yeah, the person that was there. That has to be sort of a club.
It must be. Yeah, they would have a phrase, a steely-eyed missile man, and this is for the men and women in mission control in Houston and also launch control in Florida. There was definitely a strong bond because, and most especially with Apollo 11, if you're looking at your computer screen and you're in charge of, you know, this tiny chunk of Apollo operating properly, I can only imagine how stressful that would be when you would say, yes, we're good to go. How could you not wonder, what have I missed?
Right.
It must have been very stressful, and stress almost always brings a stress in a community where you're all working and striving towards a particular end goal. You can only but have a really strong camaraderie after it.
Right. From a scientific perspective, it's hard to overstate the impact of this from a science. How do you sort of view that time in American history for, you know, looking ahead 50 years to now?
Yeah.
How much really came from that sort of exploration, that sort of dedication at the time?
There's sort of that can-do spirit. I mean, even now it's shorthand. Like, we can send a guy to the moon, but we can't, you know, whatever.
Right.
Metal in the microwave or whatever it might be. but it's sort of become shorthand for, you know, we can achieve these great things as a nation. And although I wish that we would continue to explore as a species, you know, the moon and Mars, I still see that we're doing some really incredible things with the International Space Station and figuring out what longevity in space does to the human body. The short answer is not a lot of good stuff.
Right.
And we're just trying to figure out how we could maybe move beyond this planet that we have. And all too often we treat it as a disposable sort of thing. And there's not enough care being taken of our planet, because every astronaut that's gotten far enough away from the Earth that they can hide it with their thumb, right, they've all said that the atmosphere is so thin, it's so delicate, that they come home and they're really transformed with the idea that we've got to take care of this little oasis in the vast void of space, because this is all we have.
You mentioned, you know, it was about more than Americans landing on the moon. It was about humans doing this amazing thing. And you also mentioned the sense of, you know, maybe the last time that we all looked toward a common goal and celebrated in this particular way. What are we missing? What are we missing out on by not having those moments? What do we need, you know, what's today? What's our moon landing now? What do we need to unite us instead of dividing us?
Wow, if I knew that, I would be in Washington, D.C. or at the UN. but what I continue to appreciate about the Apollo program is we're so focused on getting to the moon and mapping the moon, and it was Apollo 8, which we sent in 1968, in December of 1968. These three men, they went, and they weren't going to land on the moon. They were just going to orbit the moon, and these three men, incredible bravery, they set off further than any other human explorers at any time. And they were so focused on getting to the moon that it wasn't until that famous photo called Earthrise, when they looked back on the moon, back on the Earth, that they realized, you know, this is the point of our mission. It wasn't so much orbiting the moon, it was looking back at the Earth. And I have that photo next to my desk sort of as a reminder of how I don't really have big problems. And I think that when you see the Earth from that far away, all these political and ideological divisions, they tend to seem less important as it is for all of us being on this gigantic spaceship called Earth together.
For people who say, why do that again? Why go back? Why haven't we gone back?
Yeah, there hasn't been the political will, really. And I guess, you know, there's this sense of, like, you know, Apollo 11 was a great adventure, and that's what people understood Apollo 11 to be. And one reason Apollo lost its funding apart from the fact that President Nixon was worried that the astronauts might get stranded up there and it wouldn't look good from a PR perspective. There was also this idea of every subsequent mission, Apollo 12, Apollo 13, Apollo 14, was the same adventure, and people get sort of bored from the same adventure. And NASA did not market as well as they really should have the scientific exploration of going to the moon and explaining, you know, going to the moon helps us understand the Earth better. And all of this sort of scientific data we've extracted from the moon has helped explain the origins of the Earth and therefore ourselves. So, I mean, going back, it's not just a great adventure, but there's so much out there that's really interesting. And I think it's good for us to turn our attention sort of beyond us.
When you explain this to your son, you know, as we are both parents, when you, you know, try to, what are some of the stories that you want him to make sure that he understands?
Yeah, I'm a bit of a nerd when I talk to my kid. I get really fired up and, you know, it's like, oh, wow, the Gemini program and everything and Apollo, Mercury and Apollo. And he's good natured and he sort of absorbs it, I guess. But I guess one of the things that I take away from the space program is this idea of keeping your eyes focused on a goal. And even when there's a setback, and we had many setbacks in the space race, most notably Apollo 1 with that fire on the launch pad, there was this idea of, you know, looking at that goal and just trying to figure out, well, how do we solve those problems? Because when Kennedy said we should go to the moon, the audacity of that is just crazy. And there was no way that he knew for certain that we would get there. He had sort of seen the rocket from Wernher von Braun that might get us there. But there was all of these other things. I mean, by the time Kennedy said, let's go to the moon, we had sent Alan Shepard up on a 15-minute straight-up, straight-down mission. We hadn't even gotten further than Bermuda in the space program. And yet he had the audacity to sort of, as a leader, sort of point us in a direction that I think was really beneficial at that point in time.
Picture this. You're an Army Green Beret fighting battles in tribal Afghanistan. Then you return home to find the battle isn't over. Retired Lieutenant Colonel Scott Mann takes the battlefield to the stage in a new play. It's emotional, it's validating, it's storytelling in service to others. Here's Scott Mann. Tell us a little bit about when you decided that theater and that writing might be a way to express your own personal journey and the journey of so many others.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, when I got out of the Army 6 years ago, I retired, and I was in a very dark place. My transition from the military, like a lot of other veterans, was just challenging. I had gone from a world that I was fully expressed, and I knew what I was doing as a Green Beret, had strategic relevance, and then all of a sudden, you know, I'm out hanging out with my family in flip-flops in Tampa, Florida. And it was a really, really tough transition for me, and it was actually some mentors who showed me the power of storytelling as a way to reintegrate back into society and take the scars and the journey from my past life and share it as leadership lessons with this new world that I lived in. And, you know, most societies on the planet have done this with warriors for centuries, but for some reason we don't. So my wife and I started a nonprofit called The Hero's Journey, and we help warriors find their voice and tell their story as a transition tool. And so as I started doing that and getting on more and more stages, people said, you know, you should consider a one-act play and use veterans as the storytellers. And that's exactly what I did. I wrote for 2 years based on all true stories, and I put together this play based on one Green Beret and his family and the impact that the war had on them over the course of, you know, 18 years now that we've been fighting. And that's what led me to do it.
And you have on this journey with you other veterans who are incredibly, creatively, professionally trained actors as well, but all of them who have personal stories of their own. Tell us about that.
You know what? That's so true. And not only is our cast that way, but our whole travel team is that way. They are either veterans or the families of veterans. And it just evolved that way. But what I knew was this story is such an emotional roller coaster, whether you're a civilian that's never served, or a Gold Star family member, or a veteran, this is a white-knuckle ride that's just an honest rendering of the impact of war abroad and at home. And so I knew that if we were going to make the room safe so that everybody in that room felt like they earned their seat, then the people on the stage had to have lived this. So we put together a four-person cast, and the three of the actors are combat veterans, two Green Berets, one paratrooper, Brian, Lenny, and myself. And then the person who plays my character's wife, her name is Lynn Patton, is also our director. Her name is AIM, and she is a military family member. And then the rest of our team, we have wounded warriors who served in Iraq. We have spouses of an Air Force veteran who committed suicide as our tour manager. It is a multi-pronged military story in and of itself, our team.
You said making the room safe, and I want to talk about the actors on stage, and then we'll talk about the audience. But for the actors and the traveling team and the people who are involved in this production, this is another act of service, generosity, vulnerability, mm-hmm. and risk. You're putting yourself into an emotional space that you could get out of. Well, maybe you can't get out of it, but you don't have to do that to yourself right. theatrically and to be present for people and to lay yourself bare like that. Why do you do it? Mm.
Thank you for asking that, and thank you for noticing that. I really appreciate it. The reason that we believe so strongly that we have to do this is that, you know, 18 years into this war, my oldest son was 3 years old when the towers fell. And next year, he's going to be an infantry lieutenant. And he's going to go fight the same war that I did not finish. And I believe that our society today does, and our politicians especially, don't fully understand the impact of a multi-generational war that we just keep going back to and going back to. It's almost like it's a video game because it's such a small percentage of people who are going, and it's the same people. And I feel so compelled as the writer and a performer, as do my castmates, that we must tell this story in a way that's never been told by voices that have never been heard. We need people to understand the impact on a military family, on the spouses, on the children. The big screen never tells their story. We need people to understand the realities of PTS and how it shows up. And we need people to understand that no matter what pain we go through in this life, no matter how bad our trauma is, we need to let go and live a life that we deserve to live. And that's why we bring it all on the stage so that the audience can experience that in an emotional, visceral level.
How do you exit the space? When the night is over, you've done the performance, you've, you know, addressed the audience, if that's the case. How do you put on your flip-flops and say it's okay to have my flip-flops on for a while?
Yeah, thank you for asking that as well. You know, what we do is a couple of things. One is we always do a talk back with the audience. We know that the content that we've talked about is tough. And so we bring the curtain up and we sit with the audience and we talk with them and we cry with them and we celebrate with them and we hold them and we don't leave. We don't leave until the last person leaves. And we make sure that they know we've got them and they've got us. And that's number one. And then the cast, we go backstage and we circle up the way we did. We hold hands and we breathe. And we just breathe out that pain and that trauma. And we take it off like we do, you know, a set of body armor. We hang it on the closet and then we go back to living the lives that we led. And it's breath work and training that allows us to do that. But closing out with that audience really is the way that we're able to exit to the next town.
All right. So let's talk about that audience because it's an experience for them. And how do you prepare the audience for what's ahead? Because many people who are going to come to the play are also the ones who are going to be affected the most by seeing these situations, by seeing the lights and the noises and the pain.
Yeah, the first thing that I tell people, and we say it in the words that come out at the beginning of the play, this is a story about war performed by those who lived it. And so the first thing you need to know is this play's about war. And it's about war on the battlefield, and it's about the war on the home front. And we're going to lift the curtain up, and we're going to tell you the story. This is a true story. Every single thing in this play is based on truth. And so you're going to experience the elements of war. And because the reason is that if we're going to keep sending our men and women to fight in these far flung places, which I believe at times we have to do, then we damn sure need to understand what it is we're asking them to do as citizens, as politicians, as leaders. And so this play does that. And we put that out right up front. And I tell people, look, you're going to come to this play. If you're a veteran or a military family member, you're going to leave validated. You're going to look and go, yep, that was my story. And you may be triggered at times. You may walk out and take a breath and come back in. We've never had anyone walk out and not come back. Most of the veterans actually just go for the ride. And when they're done, you just see this big sense of validation. The civilians who have never experienced this, they typically come up with tears in their eyes and say, I had no idea. I had no idea. Thank you for showing me this. And now I better understand the journey that my neighbors are on. And so we're really upfront with it. We're really honest. And then again, we just sit with the audience at the end. We talk about what came up for them. We have a psychologist that travels with us that deals with trauma. We'll do PTS interventions right on the spot if we need to. But we're there with the audience and we all go for the ride together.
I want to go back to something you said about living a life we deserve, because I want to get to this idea, and you have a statewide audience here with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Not everyone's going to make it to the show. Many people are. I hope they fill up the seats. But for people who are this is going to be their experience with this story, and we'll put some links up on our website so they can find more at listen.sdpb.org. Let's talk about what's on the other side of that validation. What's on the other side of feeling that pain? What's possible if you go through, because it's so easy to resist even, you know, I don't want to talk about that. I want to put that chapter behind me. I don't want that to be part of my story. Can I just be someone else who never had that experience?
Right.
Why enter the cave, really?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And my experience has been that, you know, the trauma that I have a ton of survivor's guilt. You know, one of the things that I wrestle with all the time is, why am I here when those men, primarily men who did what I asked them to do, are not here? How can I even do this? And that pain can be debilitating. It will cause me to just go dark, you know, crawl inside a hole, mood swings with my family, and just pull back from everything in my life. And what I've learned, and I still have to battle with it, though, is that those scars that I have in my life, whether you served in the military or not, we as humans, we all go through struggle. We all go through trauma. It's part of living. But if we can find in our heart a path to repurpose our struggle in the service of others, if we can talk about how leadership on the battlefield can help other people see a path for their future, why relationships with an Afghan tribal elder are so important, the same way that you restore a relationship with a coworker, to let it go, to let go of the pain, let go of the trauma, and stand in your power. It's so needed in our world today. And that's, you know, for me, that's why this is so worth it, is that all of us are holding on to something that we need to let go of. And when we do, that's when we find a sense of strength and power and leadership in our lives that we've never had before. And that trauma and that struggle can actually be repurposed into gold if we do that. And that's what this play hopefully shows to every single audience member in there, whether they served or not.
Can we repurpose that struggle alone, or is by definition the journey forward in some kind of community, in a safe community?
Well, as a Green Beret and someone who teaches the power of relationships in this world, that's what I teach, is human connection. I will tell you that humans are the most social creatures on the planet. We're able to do the things that we do in our life and build the things that we build because of our social nature. We don't have fur, fangs, or claws, but we know how to build teams better than anyone else. And we absolutely must connect with other human beings if we're going to have the impact in this world that we want to have. And that includes, if we've been through trauma, if we've been through struggle, trying to go through that on your own is an immensely dangerous proposition. I've seen brothers of mine, Navy SEALs, Army Rangers, Delta, Green Berets, who have killed themselves because they thought they could walk this valley alone. And I do not believe in it, and I do not subscribe to it. I believe that the same way that as warriors we got through life as a team, as a tribe, the same thing must happen on the other side. And frankly, the reason we're taking this play to Vermilion and not necessarily Manhattan right now is because I believe it is our community that will help bring our warriors home, not the VA. It is our community that will find resilience to overcome PTS and to bring these high-performing leaders back into the fold where they're leading our children. And so I believe it's absolutely something we must go through together, and that the community at Vermilion in that audience, it needs to be veterans, civilians who've never seen the military, Gold Star families, all sitting together and coming together as a community to talk about and deal with this tough issue we call war.
Democracy Established, Democracy Challenged, Democracy Restored. Chandrahar Dvaiti is a distinguished professor emeritus at South Dakota State University, and he joined us to talk about what goes into the establishing of a democracy and how recent elections in India influenced the expression of democratic principles. Looking at democracy overseas might serve as a reminder of what a fantastic feat American democracy continues to be. Welcome. Thank you for being here with us in the STPB Sioux Falls studios. Welcome back.
Thank you, Lodi. Good morning.
All right.
Appreciate the opportunity.
So one of the things this summer with the recent election in India, for perspective, was just what a huge exercise in democracy this is. How many people have to vote? Like 900 million,
people,
eligible voters in India, and a pretty high voter turnout.
That's quite remarkable, you know. In the country like India, about 60% of the population is rural, where access to technology is very limited, but still, you know, turnout is great.
So part of, how do they make that happen? They come to you in India. They sort of bring the voting booth to everyone. Like, you're not supposed to travel for more than about, you know, 2 miles.
Yeah.
I read this on NPR.
Yeah.
So they're talking about there's the massive machinery that has to happen.
Unlike here, election throughout the country, one day, but there they have a, you know, different days. It takes about a month to have elections. So they start planning early on. So as you could see, you know, it takes a month to get the election done.
Right.
And it's a very slow process.
Right. So in your presentation, where are you going to begin when you talk about democracy in India? You're going to go back to British rule and independence?
Yeah, you know, it was a quite distinct pleasure for all of us. In fact, when India became independent, I was not born. I was born a year after.
Yeah.
So with 200 years British rule, people were overwhelmed with the independence. But after independence, you know, it was not easy. During the country was divided, and during the division, a lot of turmoil, and approximately 1 million people died. And especially the conflict between Hindu and Muslim, partly because of the suppression of Pakistan. And during that time, Mahatma Gandhi played a major role to stop the bloodshed. Mm. And unfortunately, because of his intervening in the conflict, resolving it, he was assassinated.
Right.
And the assassination was done by an organization which is known as RSS, Rashtriya Swayam Sevak Sangh. Name sounds great, you know, it's like a volunteer organization for country. But it consists of extremist Hindus who believe, you know, India should be a Hindu country. Mm-hmm. But after independence, Mahatma Gandhi and other leaders like Nehru and others, they wanted India as a secular country. So that was the conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually the extremist group did not like it. They wanted independence from British, but they wanted Hindu India. But the leaders at that time, I really admire them, you know, they were way ahead. Even India, 80% Hindus.
Right. 80%
Hindus. Uh-huh. But the leaders always visioned that India is a secular country. And I give credit to our forefathers and leaders, you know, how they visioned, and that's how we are world's largest democracy in country, right. in the world.
The world's largest democracy.
In the world.
And Mahatma Gandhi, he wanted this secular India. Because what did he say about that? Why did he?
He said, we are children of the God. Mm. It doesn't matter who we are all the same. So our country should welcome and encourage them to contribute to the country. Equally, it doesn't matter whether you are Hindu, whether you are Muslim or Christian or Sikh. So that was his thought. And extremists didn't like it. And they thought, you know, he favored the Muslims. And they assassinated him. Now, coming back to it relates to modern history.
Right, yeah.
So that group, RSS, later on developed a political wing.
Sure.
And the political wing was named as Janasangh, which is now named as Bharatiya Janata Party. So BJP, and our current prime minister belongs to that group. So that's a really concern at this time that, you know, our current prime minister belongs to an extremist group, and that group assassinated Mahatma Gandhi, and there is a danger of country may go towards Hindu nationalism.
How long has this current prime minister been in power? This is a fairly long stretch.
This is second term.
Second term.
So it's hard to go in 15 minutes, you know, how Indian democracy right. works. So he got selected in 2015. And that time, you know, before him, two term of the Congress government, and Dr. Manmohan Singh was the prime minister. Mm-hmm. So there's always, you know, incumbency factor. When you have been power for 10 years, there are a lot of things happens and, you know, right. people think we need a change. And that's how his party came into power. Even, as I said, you know, India has 80% Hindus, but even 2014, his party got only 31% of the votes. So even all Hindus do not subscribe to the Hindu nationalism.
Right.
So when he got into power, he is great showman. He knows how to sell himself. And he comes with the slogans. And during his first term as prime minister, he will travel internationally and meet international leaders. And he has typical hug. For that, and that gives an image in India that he had capability to be a good friend with the international leaders, and he is willing to serve India and solve all the problems. Mm. And of course, he had a lot of pressure from his group to take country to the Hindu nationalism. But right. unfortunately, he was figuring out if he does, he will be out. So he did not take any major steps towards the Hindu nationalism. That's why his base is not even very happy with him. But
sure.
they always think it's better to have someone who belongs to us rather than having a stranger. So his first five-year term was not really great. He has a number of the flagship program. Most of them did not succeed very well. But he's, as I said, he's a very good salesperson. His billboards and all over the country, every block, everywhere. So he sells himself very good. And he changes his name because he always connects to the poor people that I am coming from a poor family because my father was a, you know, tea vendor. And then if he goes to a bigger group, then there's an Indian word, chokidar. Chokidar means guard. I'm a poor man and I'm guarding this country. So he just changes right. different names.
He knows his audience.
Audience. And
he
connects with
directly
them. So
to
that's
them.
One great thing with him. He yeah. connects with the audience and great showman.
Yeah. So it, with 80% Hindus, India still has an incredibly strong Muslim minority.
Yeah, it's about 14% are Muslims.
Yes.
And about, you know, 6% others, Christians and Buddhists and others.
How have they been responding to his the mandate for him to stay and really have even more influence?
No, in fact, you know, Muslims are not really, since they are a small minority, and you do not see much, you know, coming from the minority, because I hate to say that most of the Muslims are not well educated. So I'm saying most, not all.
Mm.
So mostly, you know, they are busy in their own thing. Sometimes they get exploited by their leaders. And so, I mean, they do not like where the country is going, but they do not have a major vice, political vice. And their leadership is weak. But one good thing I would say in this respect, there's a lot of integration happening, that Hindus are marrying non-Hindus. And especially, I would mention the Bollywood. In Bollywood, they are always integrated. And in India masses, Bollywood has a tremendous power.
Really?
I think Hollywood doesn't have that much power here.
Right, yeah.
But there, Bollywood has much power.
So influence of the arts.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So Bollywood, a lot of integration. And similarly, the political leaders, and I would say educated intellectuals, there are a lot of integrations, you know, Hindu-Muslim weddings and Hindu-non-Hindu weddings. Mm. I think that group is very strong. And they will do whatever it takes to stop him.
Right.
And again, I said, you know, in 2014, he got 31% of votes. And of course, he increased his percentage in 2019, now 37%. But still, you could see out of 80% Hindus, he's getting only 37% vote. Mm-hmm. So majority of the Hindus do not subscribe to Hindu nationalism. So I think, as it has happened in India earlier, in 1975, when Indira Gandhi was prime minister, she was accused of some, you know, election frauds. Mm-hmm. And she was asked by court to resign. But during the time, rather than resigning, she had a suspension of civil liberties. She used the word emergency. And the emergency was for almost 2 years. Very similar situation. No civic liberties. All the opposition leaders were in the jail. And you cannot express yourself. Very similar, you know, autocratic right. and dictatorial. But the country got together and they ousted him in 2 years.
Yeah.
So I think if a situation comes like this, I'm pretty hopeful, you know, the yeah. country will come together and will block the Hindu nationalism.
And there are people who, I mean, that's a fairly recent memory for many Indians people.
They
remember that time. They remember what happened, and they have a sense of how to move forward.
Indians are even... I would say literacy is improving, but still a large majority are not very well educated.
Yeah.
But they are very conscious about their civil liberties. People like to talk. People will get together at like here at coffee house, we call it, you know, tea stalls. People come, chat. So that's one thing. If that's stopped, people don't take it well and they react. And that's how happened during the Mrs. Indira Gandhi's time. So,
are you still seeing the legacy of Mahatma Gandhi?
Oh, yes.
In some of those conversations, just the influence and the power that he had is still something people are
admire,
have not forgotten.
They admire.
Yeah.
I think as time goes on, he is admired much more than what people were admiring him when, you know, he was assassinated. So his legacy is, you know, lifelong for every Indian. And not only Indian, you know, you go anywhere in the world, you know, if they know, they know Mahatma Gandhi.
He studied in American schools.
And he was a really true Mahatma. You know, Mahatma is a Sanskrit word, means great soul. His family, he didn't do anything for his family. His family, they are, you know, ordinary citizens. He, I think if I know, a couple of his grandchildren are in United States. Hmm. And people do not know even that they are related to, you know, Mahatma Gandhi. So he was thinking entire world is his family. And lot of people, you know, when you grow up and see his views, you admire him.
Yeah.
I don't know whether you had time to read his book, My Experiment with the Truth. That's his biography.
Whenever I
have a down moment, I read the book. I must have read that book more than 100 times. And every time, it gives me a new inspiration.
Something new to read.
Yeah.
Well, this is an inspiring conversation as well. What's it like for you, before I let you go, to sort of watch democracy from your country of the United States and watch democracy from the country of your birth at the same time, really go through challenges and...
Well, I hate to be, I think both countries, you know, United States and India, are going through this similar turbulence. And I'm hoping, you know, as my adopted country, U.S., the struggling through certain issues, and I have strong confidence, you know, will come out of this time. And similarly, I'm quite hopeful, you know, India will have the similar experience.
The In the Moment podcast is produced by Josh Heyer. Follow us on Instagram at SDPB In the Moment and Twitter at In the Moment. Have a story idea? Send us an email, inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Josh Heyer, Chris Lawfrey, and Steve Zwemke, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.